Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
Did you ever wander into an old house and wonder who lived here? Or find a puzzling inscription in an old book? What did it mean? So many lives with their secrets gone. Or are they? Author Daniel Mason's exhilarating, century-spanning novel, Northwoods, attempts to answer that question, laying out how past inhabitants of a house, say, two early Puritans, intersect with the current owner, a 21st-century botanist, how they weave ghost-like tendrils into the present, like dormant spores deep in the woods, which will later awake to take down forests. Mason's past novels include The Piano Tuner and the Pulitzer Prize finalist, A Registry of My Past Passage Upon Earth. He's also a practicing psychiatrist at Stanford Hospital in California, where he grew up. The New York Times says Northwoods is impossible to summarize, but I tried when we sat down in Boston with Daniel Mason at WBUR City Space. Where'd this come from?
Well, so the idea for the book came back during the pandemic, back when there were fires in California. My family came out to upstate New York.
And you start seeing houses. What are you thinking?
So this is something that growing up and spending most of my life in California, I'm not used to seeing. One doesn't wander around the Bay Area and find the ruins of houses. And yet there are these walls everywhere, and there are these cellar holes everywhere. And we just began to think of the space as something that really existed over time, and in which one could see elements of the past in the present as well.
So now we come to the story, which is one house and the occupants over 300 years. You know, two young lovers escaping a Puritan colony, a mother escaping an Indian attack, many murderous attacks involving axes, a delightful Englishman on the wrong side of the Revolutionary War. His family thinks him mad because he dreams of an apple orchard. It's not the first time we hear about madness in the book and treatments. In his case, the treatment will be bread soaked in raccoon seed that has been bound for 3 days to the udders of an unwashed ewe. Was that a real treatment?
I don't know.
Oh.
It's not now.
It sounded like a good idea.
Yeah.
How much fun speaking the different language of all the different characters.
It was a lot of fun. I didn't think that I was going to do that when I started. And then I started reading these sources and doing the research. I mean, it had this kind of infectious quality. It's like finding a kind of instrument and wondering what's it like to play on it. I have been asked a couple times at reading whether pomomania is a real thing.
That's a craze for apples that you assigned him, but it may not be real.
He's the only person I know who's been diagnosed with
pomomania. And there's the wife. I believe it's the early 1900s. This is when the clairvoyant comes. The wife who is hearing ghosts of male lovers in her house, and she's too embarrassed to tell the clairvoyant. So she tries to find a word that rhymes with sodomy. You come up with that word. The topics. We watch a spore in an ecstatic journey, propelled by the wind, tumbling giddily, leaping the Catskills to the Hudson, up the Taconic's flanks. Lucky spore. Now it's riding a raindrop to reach a thriving chestnut in Western Mass, where she, the spore, will lie dormant until time to decimate a forest.
Yeah. That's the story of the chestnut blight. This whole area was covered by these magnificent, enormous chestnut trees. And that's a story that's been told before, right? Though I knew I'd have to tell it for this book. But right. I was sort of interested in it from the spore's point of view.
And we feel like voyeurs in another section. I'm wondering if you could read a little bit where somehow we are witnessing beetles copulating. The female has burrowed into a log, releasing her pheromones that drift out.
Let the record show that of the many different chapters I could have read from, this was not the one that I chose. But I will read it. And what perfume? 3,04-methyl-3-heptanol, alpha-multistriatin, alpha-cubabine. Can we fault then the young swain who, flying by, paused mid-flight, swiped the air with his antennae, and made a U-turn towards her borehole? Shivers of lust passed through his elytra as he found her scent grow stronger. And beneath the bark, within the gallery, what heaven! The scent was overwhelming. He purred and dipped, so befuddled by her smell, he nearly mated with a mite. And it goes on.
it goes on. I think I was actually a little turned on by the male beetle's swollen adigas.
Yeah. It is the, yes.
But so we're talking about botany, modern and historical, and climate change, and the composition of ancient woods and gardens and painting and literature and skirmishes between, early settlers and Indians and bounty hunters during slavery. You wrote the bulk of this in 1 year?
Most of it, yeah. You know, that said, I think like any writer will tell you a lot of this stuff's on a pretty long fuse. So like the chapter about the sisters, I've been thinking about a pair of twin sisters for 20 years. I had a friend who had a pair of aunts who never married, who lived together in a house and at a certain point in time had stopped speaking with each other and so left each other notes. And the family would find these notes, and the notes became this kind of register of all the conversations and all the discussions that they had. And so when this time came and all of a sudden I have this apple farmer and he's these two daughters, and I'm thinking, twins, well, there's this story that I've been thinking of for this long period of time, two people who are so intimate and at the same time have this sort of intense falling out, that was there.
Well, without giving too much away, people get out of their own chapters and haunt others, and threads are lost and then picked up, things resurface, and people will never, ever know.
Right. It's almost like these are sort of stage props that are sitting around for the next people who come in the next chapter to pick up. But they're stripped of meaning. And I just love that. And I think anyone who's gone through the belongings of a loved one who's passed away or who's been to a tag sale, you know, finds all these objects which at one time meant something very different than they do in the moment that when they're taken out of someone's hands.
That broke my heart. The axe head surfaces, nobody has any idea what that axe head did. In a way, you're redefining time here. There's no beginning and end. There's this constant.
Yeah, it goes back to this idea that it's very hard for me to imagine. I live in this time scale, which at times life seems like it moves by very fast, and other times it moves by so slowly. And yet at the same time, like when I take a step back and I think of almost anything else around me, the time scale that I live in is so insignificant. And this book doesn't even get into geologic time. I didn't think that the book was going to end where it ended. I wrote the chapters that the book takes place in the months that they took place in. That was kind of a rule. So the book begins in June, and that's
the kids running away.
And that's sort of when I came out and started working on it. And then it was around the fall when all the trees were dropping their apples and all the colors. When I realized that I was writing this chapter about Charles Osgood and his apple trees, even though, you know, hundreds of years are passing, it still moves from essentially a January chapter to essentially a February chapter. I really would go for a walk with my dog in the afternoon. If I wanted to know what was blooming then, it was what was blooming outside.
The characters, where'd they come from?
Probably like a lot of writers, I kind of go around with these imaginary friends. But some of them, you know, like for example, the clairvoyant. Like I love the history of seances, very important in the history of psychiatry. And I've always thought this would be wonderful to use this kind of character that for the most part of her life isn't able to access the beyond.
Oh, she's a fraud.
She's a total fraud until.
Right. The young man who is diagnosed with schizophrenia.
Sure. He was someone actually I was reluctant to write about at first because I've always found it hard to write about psychiatry. And yet at the same time, this idea of somebody who finds solace, a kind of comfort, or sort of refuge in the woods is kind of person that I've thought about.
What are you saying as a psychiatrist? So many portraits of mental illness in the book. We mentioned Alice and Mary, and Mary is at times a complete and frightening puzzle to her twin, but we maybe see from our vantage point, that looks bipolar. There's the young man that we spoke of, Robert, who's diagnosed as a schizophrenic, in part because he's hearing voices, but then he's not just hearing voices. Those voices are real. And I wondered, you know, do you believe that that's possible, or is that maybe a wish?
The psychiatry in the book in some ways is a mess. Part of writing and part of being a clinician is, you know, trying to separate myself from the impulse as a clinician to sort of diagnose and simplify, because I don't think that makes good characters. The good characters are ones that are messy and confusing and somehow mysterious. As far as his experience goes, I mean, it's odd to say I don't No, I guess, because, you know, I should know if I wrote it, but many of the things that he does look very different from crazy. So he's somebody who believes on some level he's capable of protecting the forest through his own actions, and he's, you know, driven to misery by this. But again, if we take a step back from that, You know, the idea that we can protect this forest through our own actions is something that the so-called sane of us probably should take a lesson from.
Well, and the notion that we should be kind of losing our minds over climate change, we should.
Right, right. But in some ways, the core belief that he holds is not one that seems mad to me at all.
Yeah. Oh, first a question from the audience. Do you believe in ghosts?
I have not experienced a ghost myself. Yeah. I mean, it's funny because I say that and then I think to myself, okay, you say you don't believe it. Would you go into a dark, empty house at nighttime with no one else around? And I would not. So it's certain, on a certain level, some degree of belief must be there.
Oh, I hated to stop. I wanted so much more. Why did you stop?
Well, it was June.
And that's where you started.
That's where I started, yeah.
Thank you so much. Daniel Mason speaking about his powerful new novel, Northwoods, at WBUR's City Space.